Thank you. Also, the, I want to acknowledge the donation of Yosef and Rachel, of the son of Yosef and Rachel Leah Perlman, in the memory of his parents, Yosef and Rachel Leah, who actually were very generous in donating some of the equipment. So, Purim. Just to give you an idea of the approximate timeline, this is approximate, this is not to scale, but Jewish history, starting pretty much in 1948, the birth of Abraham. That's 1948 from creation, that's not 1948 CD. But Abraham born 1948. The Jews, a couple of hundred years later, go to Egypt. They get out of Egypt in the year 2448, in the Jewish year 2448. That's approximately 1313. BCE, and after getting out of Egypt, 480 years later, King Solomon builds the first temple. We have the first king is King Saul, followed by King David, and King David's son, Shlomo HaMelech. King Solomon builds the first temple. The first temple lasts for approximately 300 or so years until the Assyrians invade. The Assyrians destroy the northern kingdom of Israel, known as Yisrael. What remains is Yehuda, Judah, hence the people from there are called Judeans or Judeus in Greek and Jews in English from Judah. In fact, the first time we're identified as Yehudim is actually in the scroll of Esther. And so now, about 100 years or so after the Assyrians invade Israel, the Babylonians, flavor of the month, come in and they conquer Israel and destroy the first temple after it was around for approximately 410 years. The Jews are exiled to Babylon, Babylonian exile, and it is in Babylon, which of course was also is in modern day Iraq, and Persian Empire, which is modern day Iran. There's some more chairs here. I see people standing there. Okay. All right. So modern day Iraq and Iran was the ancient Babylonian and later Persian and Median Empire. And the Jews were exiled to there. Not all of the Jews, but most of the vast majority of the Jews are exiled to Babylon and became part of the Persian and Babylonian social, economic and political fabric. And it was during that period of time that the Jews are in Persia, Babylon, Persia, that is when Purim happened. In blue there, Purim happened. About 70 years after the destruction of the temple, as a result of the Purim story, which we'll talk about, the second temple, about 40,000 Jews came from Babylon back to Israel under Ezra and Nehemiah. There was a proclamation of Cyrus the Great, Koresh Cyrus, who proclaimed that people can come back to their countries. He doesn't explicitly mention Jews in his cylinder, but according to our sources, the Jews were allowed to come back to Israel. Ezra and Nehemiah started building the walls around Jerusalem, building the temple. That was stopped. And it was started again after the Purim story. So we have the Second Temple, about halfway into the time of the Second Temple, a little less than halfway, 150 or so years. We have the Hanukkah story. Then about 200 years after that, the Romans invade Israel, destroy the Second Temple, exile the Jews all over the world. Gaul, Sparta, Hispania, England, New Jersey, etc. And then we have, after the in the Roman period, 170 to 200, we have the writing of the Mishnah. That's followed by a couple of hundred years later, more than that, about 500, 600, 700 CE. There are disputes about it. The end of the Talmud, the Gemara, followed by the period known as the Gaonim. You may have heard of Sa'adja Gaon, etc. And followed, that ended with around the death of Rabbeinu Gershom in 1038 and the birth of Rashi, of course, the most famous commentator. And then Maimonides, Nachmanides, Code of Jewish Law, Hasidic Movement, Rav Moshe Chaim Luzzatto, and then we get to New Rochelle, 5779. So that's more or less Jewish history in 2 minutes. Now you know. In Babylon, we have a very famous psalm written by King David, in which he prophetically talks about the Jews being by the rivers of Babylon's very famous one, Al-Naharot Bavel, by the rivers of Babylon, where we sat and we wept and we remembered Zion. There we hung our kinorim, our harps, And our captor said, sing to us songs of Israel. And we said, how can we sing the songs of God on foreign soil? And there the Jews took a very famous oath, which we still repeat today at weddings. Im eshkachech, Yerushalayim, if I forget thee, O Jerusalem, let my right hand forget its cunning. If I do not exalt thee over all my joy, let my tongue cleave to the roof of my mouth. This is why at weddings, what do we do at weddings to commemorate this, to fulfill this oath? We break something of value under the chuppah as a commemoration of that, fulfillment of that. Here is a picture, is actually from Nineveh, the palace of Sancheriv, and it actually shows Jewish captives going into exile. This is the oldest representation of Jews that we know of from the time of the destruction of the first temple. And these Jews, here is an Assyrian soldier. You can see he's carrying a mace, and you can see the hilt of his sword, which you have on the on his left. If you're right-handed, you draw your sword that way. Well, iujitsu, my good friend Howard Sober, Professor Sober, who I teach with in Yeshiva University, could not come tonight. He told me he is teaching a class in Taiji sword fighting in another neighborhood here. So I don't know if anyone, there may be people here who are at that class. So, anyway, he's a world-class martial artist. So here, and what are the Jews carrying in their hands? Can you see that? Harps. And it's a beautiful, I mean, it's sad, but it's a very beautiful reflection of the reality of King David's psalm that we went into Babel with our kinorot, with our harps. And here is another picture of the Assyrians, actually, taking the Jews into exile. On the bottom, you see an Assyrian soldier. And there are Jews with their burdens over their shoulders marching out of Israel into exile. It was very traumatic, the exile to Babel. Traumatic because we'd been living in Israel for over 800 years as free people, independent country. And after 800 years of that, bam, the temple's destroyed, Jerusalem's in ruins, the Jews are in exile, we don't have our independence. And this, these events are also recorded in non-Jewish history in a clay tablet in Babylonian cuneiform, which talks about the fall of Jerusalem. And here is Nebuchadnezzar's cylinder, which is 6th century BCE, talking again about the conquest of Jerusalem, the conquest of Israel. Daniel was one of the earliest Jews to be exiled. In the exile to Babylon, one of the Jews exiled, his name was Daniel. He was of a noble family, and he was a teenager at the time. We're not exactly sure his age, but he was an older teenager, 17, 18. And he, with a group of Jews, were taken to Babylon. Now, the Babylonians were interested in absorbing the Jews into their government and their culture. They knew the Jews were talented, they knew the Jews were smart, and they wanted to have them as part of their culture. And Daniel and these teenagers were taken and were put under the control of a certain satrap, one of the king's servants. And he said he needed to fatten them up because they looked, there was a war, they were thin, so he wanted to give them food. Daniel said, we're not going to eat the king's food because obviously it's not kosher. He said, give us seeds and water, poppy seeds and water, and we'll survive on that. The servant is hysterical because the king's going to have his head, literally, if these Jews do not look good. And yet, miraculously, they survive on seeds and water. And this, of course, as you might know, is the origin of why we eat montashen. Because the code of Jewish law says it is customary to eat food with seeds on Purim, in memory of the seeds that Daniel and his friends ate in Babylon. Because Daniel was one of the first Jewish heroes of Babylonian exile, which we, of course, Purim is the festival of the Babylonian exile, and he ate seeds. Now, as you probably know in Yiddish, right, what is the word for poppy seeds? Mon. What are pockets? Tushin. So it's mon tushin, the traditional food. Later in history, this is a... if anyone's interested in Jewish food, not just eating it, but reading about it, I know, right? There's a wonderful encyclopedia of Jewish food by Gil Marx. And his entry on montashen, he points out in the medieval, it was called montashen, which is a mouth stuffed with poppy seeds. It became a middle pocket. Now, in the Middle High German word tush also gave rice, the English word task and tax, where the money was put. It means pocket or pouch. Around the late 16th century, influenced by an Italian custom and the similarity of the word mon to homon, so people added a hey, and they renamed the original montaschen as hamantaschen. And then, ex post facto, people come up with all types of weird theories about Haman being a Vulcan with the triangular ears and the tricolored corner hat, which, of course, didn't exist in Persia at the time. And people, all types of bizarre theories. They're all wrong, right? They're all ex post facto. The actual idea is montaschen, which is pockets of poppy seeds. So that's why we eat montaschen. That dates back to Daniel. And here is a contemporary picture of the tomb of Daniel, the prophet, in Iran, in a city called Susa, or as we call it in Hebrew, Shushan, which is where the Purim story occurred. Daniel's tomb is there. It is guarded as a national antiquities monument in Iran, and it is visited and prayed at by Muslims and Jews in Iran, and it is protected by the government. It's magnificent. That is the tomb, believed to be the tomb of Daniel the prophet, mentioned by Binyamin of Tudela in his travels in the 16th century, and mentioned a little earlier in the 7th century also by another traveller. That's the tomb of Daniel. Now, here is a little bit of a picture of the map of the Persian Empire, which, as you can see, after they conquered Jerusalem, and it goes extends all the way to Babylon and what we call Iran and Iraq today, a very large empire. And as you can see, this is just superimposed on the modern day map, but the town that we're talking about, Susa, right there is what they call it today in Iran, but actually in the Megillah Esther it's called Shushan. There were two capital cities, much like in Russia, right, where you had St. Petersburg and Moscow, summer and winter. So also in Iran there were two capital, Persepolis, I don't know how you pronounce it, Persepolis, and Shushan, Susa, and there were two almost identical palaces in both places. But our story takes place, the Jews come out of Israel, they are in, a lot of them are in Shushan, the capital city. Now, in Ezra, in the book of Ezra, he tells us that in the first year of Cyrus the king issued a decree, in fact, in which he, concerning the house of God in Jerusalem, and he said, let the house be built, the place where they offered sacrifices, and let its foundations be strongly told. So Cyrus the Great, Cyrus the King, allows the Jews, he makes a decree and a proclamation to allow the Jews to rebuild the temple in Jerusalem. And he even donates, and look at the last line, it's not completely altruistic, but that's okay, right? That they may bring pleasing sacrifices to the God of heaven and pray for the life of the king and his sons. And there is a cylinder, a very famous cylinder, called the Cyrus Cylinder, which is this. There's only one of its kind in the entire world. And the Cyrus Cylinder says, I am Cyrus, king of the universe, the great king, the powerful king, king of Babylon, king of Sumer and Akkad, etc. A little modest here. Sounds like Ozymandias, right? Okay. Anyway, but he says, the sanctuary is across the river Tigris. He says, I collected together all their people and returned them to their settlements. And indeed, he allowed the Jews to go back to Israel, and the Cyrus Cylinder, very famous in the Tehran Museum in Iran. And I did not see it in Iran, but it is in the museum there. And it's interesting, in 371, Cyrus encouraged Zerubbabel, the leader of the Jews, to return to Israel, rebuild the temple. It was delayed. There were Samaritans there who were enemies of the Jews. In fact, in the book of Ezra, they talk about building the temple with, and the walls of Jerusalem, with a sword in one hand and a trowel in the other. We were trying to build, our enemies were trying to stop us building. This sounds very contemporary, as I'm sure you know. We're trying to build Israel, our enemies try to stop. It's not something new. And it was Ahasuerus, King Ahasuerus, who actually stopped the building of the temple, partially at the request of the Samaritans. Now, Ahasuerus, who we believe was Xerxes. Why do I think he was Xerxes? Because in Persian pronunciation, Xerxes is actually a Greek pronunciation, Xerxes. But in Persian, it's pronounced Hashiarsh. Hashiarsh, what's the Hebrew? Ahasuerus. What's the Persian? Chashiarsh. Say Ahasuerus and Chashiarsh 20 times fast together. No one wants to do this. Okay. Right, so, but probably Chashiarsh or Xerxes. One of the Xerxes was Ahasuerus, and we have an inscription that's in the British Museum of Chashiarsh, and he built a very beautiful royal palace, which was excavated. They've actually been excavated for about 100 years by the Delaf. It started by the Delafois from France. And here he again, on this inscription, I am Xerxes, the great king, king of kings, king of countries. Of course, the scroll of Esther starts saying that he is indeed king of 127 countries, from east, from Ethiopia to India to Ethiopia. Although there is a view in the Talmud that India, it doesn't mean India to Ethiopia, it means India to a place called Kush, which is right near India. So last summer I was in India leading a tour of India, and in the north of India there is a mountain range called the Hindu Kush Mountains. In Hebrew, it says Mehodu India ad Kush. So some say he ruled 127 countries as he ruled Hindu Kush, which are right near each other. In other words, his power was such that even though he had 127 countries spread all over the place, he ruled them just like he ruled Hindu Kush, which are right near each other, Hindu and Kush. Okay, that could be. Here is an aerial view of the palace of Ahasuerus, which Darius had built a palace, and Ahasuerus had filled with about a million cubic meters of earth and created a huge platform over the old palace and built his palace on top of there in the city of Susa. And the excavations are phenomenal. These are bases of pillars in his palace. There were 72 columns, each one 65 foot high. And they weighed approximately 28 tons each. And the area of the what's called the Apadna is the hall, the reception hall of the palace. The area of the Apadna was approximately 3 acres. That's a nice chasana, you know, if you have to pay for a hall, a 3-acre hall, the waiters must have been going out of their mind. But the palace of Ahasuerus, which has been excavated, we believe this is a palace, and indeed we are told that the floor was beautiful marble, and there was ribbons and fabric which was tied up from column to column to make a very beautiful party, and that's the remnant of the Apadna. Here are, in Persepolis, some of the pillars which still survive. And as you can see, magnificent. And if you can imagine 72 of them in a 3-acre reception room, which is, of course, the party which Megillat Esther begins with. Here is a reconstruction of what they think the outside looked like by Delafoy from France. And here, of course, is the original excavations that they did. Now, the party which the Megillah starts with is interesting. One thing which is emphasized on Purim is drinking wine. Now, if we look, the Greek historian Herodotus tells us it is the Persians' general practice to deliberate upon affairs of weight when they are drunk. And then on the morrow, when they're sober, the decision to which they came the night before is put before them by the master of the house in which it was made. If it is then approved, they act on it. If not, they set it aside. Sometimes, however, when they are sober at their first deliberation, but in this case, they always reconsider the matter under the influence of wine. I think this would be a great idea for Congress, frankly. We do this in the Australian Parliament, and I think we're doing pretty well. Right? So, by the way, this Herodotus' insight gives you a very interesting insight into the Scroll of Esther, who is what are Haman and Ahasuerus doing frequently? Drinking. They're drinking together. Right? They're drinking together. And Esther invites them to parties. What are the parties called? Mishteh, which is? Drinking. Drink is a big deal. Strabo. The Persians' consultations on the most important affairs are carried on while they're drinking. And they consider resolutions made at that time more to be dependent upon than those made when sober. Amazing. Now, the Persians had, these are what's called rhytons. They're from the National Museum in Tehran. And I bought a replica. This is a what the approximate, this is the size. This was made of solid gold. My replica is 3D printed of plastic. But this is actually what they would drink from. So this held about, as you can see, about half a litre. So these are the gold rhytons. And if you look in the scroll of Esther, what does it say? Vahashkot bikli zahav. Drinking in golden vessels. The kelim, mikelim, shanim, and all types of different utensils. This is actually from that period, right? Ancient Persian drinking vessels known as rhytons, a lion, and many, many different configurations of them in Persia. Here are Herodotus on what Persians did at the parties, which will also explain the Scroll of Esther. Of all the days in the year, the one which they celebrate most is their birthday, customary to have the board furnished in that day with an ampler supply than common. Richer Persians caused an ox, a horse, a camel, and an ass to be baked whole and served up to them. That sounds good. The poorer classes use instead smaller kinds of cattle. They eat little solid food, but an abundance of dessert. They are very fond of wine and drink it in large quantities. To vomit or obey natural calls in the presence of another is forbidden amongst them. Such are their customs in this manner. That's why the Scroll of Esther tells us, Hashtiyah kedat ein ones. The party that is thrown at the beginning of Scroll of Esther, it's interesting, the Scroll of Esther emphasizes, ein ones, no one was forced to drink. Regular Persian parties, there was a lot of pressure to drink, and to drink a lot. This was a party where they were not obligated to drink a lot. That's a magnificent example of a rhyton found in Gilan in Iran. Again, as you see, the lion motif, solid gold, holds about half a litre at least of wine. And you can imagine these parties were quite something. And that's the party at the beginning. And here are some from the British Museum in London where you can see them. This is the, I have the replica of that one. Quite amazing. Now, the festival is called Purim because Haman cast a lottery. Pur is the Persian for lottery. Okay? And Purim is plural. Now, it's interesting. Yale University Museum has this, which is a lot from 9th century BCE Persia, and that is the prototype of the type of Pur that was cast by Haman. If you go to Yale University Museum, that is the, on the labelling, it's labelled as a Pur. I actually have a replica, and this is a Pur. So now when you see Purim, you know this is actually the Pur. I'll pass it around. It's only worth $25, so don't even think of stealing it. It's not like it. But anyway, now, inscribed on this Pur is a tribute to a god, Yahali. But what's interesting is it was not used like our die. We don't do it like a die. You'd throw, and then it would recite land on. But that's not how it was used. Archaeologists believe one of two possibilities. Either they had a chart with the various months, and then you'd throw it, and wherever it landed, that would be the month. Hence, Haman chose the month of Adar. Or they had a narrow-necked... They had a narrow-necked vessel, which they'd shake around with a bunch of these in it, and you'd throw it, and whichever one came out, that would indicate what the lot was. So I don't know if anyone... Everyone's familiar with the festival called Purim, but it's probably the first time you've seen a Pur, I'm guessing. Okay, so that is the Pur. There's a fellow in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, who produces biblical replicas, and so I buy stuff from him. Obviously, this is not the type of things that an individual can buy. Governments can't even buy this. You know, I mean, there's a right. So that was the Pur. Here are some coins from Persia. And, of course, this is a coin with a picture of Xerxes on it, Hashiarsh or Ahasuerus. Of course, when Haman promises the king lots of coins, gold, silver, etc., those are the coins he's talking about. And, as you know, the king sealed his decree with his signet ring. And here are two types of seals from ancient Persia. One is a seal that was rolled onto a paper. The other is a signet ring, which the king would press into the soft clay, and that will be sealed. Now, if you know, in the Scroll of Esther, we are told that to the rulers of every province, each according to his writing, every person in their own language. This is an inscription from ancient Persia, indeed in three languages. The Scroll of Esther tells us that the kings, like in many countries, they will give out official government documents in multiple languages. In Israel, it's in Hebrew, Arabic, and English. In the United States, usually it's English and Spanish. Okay. So in the Persian Empire, things were done in multiple languages because it was a large country. So this is actually in Persian, Elamite, and Babylonian. The alphabet's the same. It's all cuneiform, which means a wedge cutting with a wedge. But that's a very that's similar. And here are the weapons, some classic Persian weapons. As you can see, they had clubs, was a very popular common weapon when the Persians stockpiled weapons to attack the Jews. And of course, as we know, the Jews stockpiled weapons to defend themselves. And these are probably the types of weapons that they would have used. Maces, you put them on the end of a wood and put on, and they're used to, you know, well, obvious. Now, in the scroll of Esther, we are told that Ahasuerus, that Esther came to the is that is the dice getting handed around? People can see. It's cool to see it. Anyway, but we are told that Esther came to the entrance of the throne room. The throne room was not that big. And I don't know if you've been to the Imperial Palace in Forbidden City in Beijing. So the actual inner throne room is not huge. Right? And but it's interesting. It says that she's not allowed to come into the throne room unless the king extends his scepter and she touches the end of it. Okay, I used to read that and say, I mean, how big is the stupid scepter, for heaven's sakes? But actually, if you look at this, you'll see how big is it. Check this out. He is sitting on a throne. He's got his feet on a footstool, and the scepter extends from there all the way up there. So the scepter is actually quite long. And if you look at the archaeological excavations of the palace in Susa, the scepter, if he would hold it out, would extend from where he was all the way to the entrance of the throne room. So if someone would come in, he could extend a scepter. And by the way, although it says it's a scepter of gold, it's not solid gold. A solid gold scepter of that length, what would first of all be very heavy, and second of all, what would happen to it? It would bend. Yes, gold is not very strong. So it was actually wood inside, and it was covered with gold. So he would hold it out, and indeed it would extend to the entrance of the throne room. So if he's sitting here, and that's the entrance of the throne room, and he's got a scepter, he could hold it out, and Esther could touch it from the entrance of the throne room. Here is, let's say, in the scroll of Esther, we are told that King Ahasuerus' name sealed it with the king's ring. They sent letters by couriers on horseback, riding on swift horses using the royal service, bred from the royal mares. And in addition, we are told, they went on Rochvei HaRetesh, they went on chariots. And the chariots actually, here's a miniature of a Persian chariot. It's from the British Museum. And it shows two riders on the chariot and three horses. There is a whole system of sending out letters. In fact, it is believed by some that the original postal service was actually founded in Persia. That was one of the most ancient postal services. Now, Iran, of course, has completely gone postal. But indeed, in following that glorious tradition. So here are some pictures of Cyrus, who is the emperor of Persia, who allowed the Jews to return to Israel. Here is Xerxes, or Ahasuerus. They're carrying an umbrella to protect him from the sun. And the headgear differs. This is headgear used for battle. And that's headgear used for regular formal wear. And here is Daryavesh, or Darius. And Darius is believed to be the son of... Darius was Jewish. Because who was his mother? Esther. Queen Esther. It always bothers me a little bit when I read the scroll of Esther to know that everyone else is rejoicing and the Jews are saved. But who has to stay in the palace of the king and live with Ahasuerus? Esther. Esther is the heroine. Esther, by the way, amongst the Jews who are conversos, who live in Spain, Portugal, and in some places in South America, who openly practice Christianity, but he had secretly practiced some levels of Judaism, one of the more popular fast days amongst them, it's hard to know exactly what they kept and did not keep, but one of the popular fast days was the fast of Esther. Why Esther? Because they saw her as the first converso, crypto-Jew. Right? They're hidden Jews. Who was the first crypto-Jew? It was Esther. Because Esther was in the palace of Ahasuerus, and what does it say? She did not tell anyone. Right? Of Maladata. She did not tell anyone of her nationality and of her religion. So she was a crypto-Jew, an inspiration for these Jews throughout history. And indeed, Esther remained, as we see, Darius was a son of Queen Esther, and we find that she's referred to as Hashegel, the concubine, who stood next to the king. Because when Darius became king, he was a kid. He was maybe 8, 9, if you calculate the years. So, but it was not uncommon in those days that you'd have, let's say, a young person as the king, and his mother, aunt or uncle, mother or uncle would control them, right? Which is actually still the custom for the mother to control someone, even when they're much older, even today. So, here is the tomb of Mordechai and Esther. Again, in Hamadan, Iran, Daniel is buried. Daniel is buried, believed to be buried near Susa, Shushan. However, Mordechai and Esther, their tombs today are believed to be in Hamadan. They are places of pilgrimage for Jews. They used to be places of pilgrimage for Muslims as well. There were protests recently, 2011, in which the Iranian authorities downgraded the status of the tomb of Mordechai and Esther, because they were, why? Because they felt that Esther and Mordechai were responsible for a massacre of 75,000 Iranians. Which is actually true, right? But that was, of course, in self-defense, because these were people who were plotting to kill the Jews. But it's fascinating, and there have been protests outside the tomb in which the students of the Basij militia threatened to tear it down. The Iranian government has protected the tomb as a holy place, but there is still word talk in Iran about destroying it, and the students don't like it because it represents the Jews' victory over the Persians at that time. Of course, we know that Iran was ruled by emperors. Eventually, we have Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, who claimed to be descended from those ancient emperors. Of course, not true at all. But and he was quite a brutal dictator, but he was a friend of Israel. I visited Iran. That's my visa from the Imperial Embassy, consular section of the Imperial Embassy of Iran, Canberra, capital of Australia. And I was there, actually, interesting. I was on a Jewish youth group going from Australia to Israel. We went from Australia to Hong Kong, and we stayed in Hong Kong for Shabbat. We took Air France to Tehran. We hung around in Tehran for a day, did some touring of Tehran. I walked around the street there with a yarmulke. No one bothered me. We went to a Jewish-owned hotel that had a kosher lunch. And then we went to the airport and got El Al from Tehran to Israel. Wow. This doesn't happen nowadays, right? But that's when we went there, and there were Jews living in Tehran. We visited a synagogue. There's a synagogue. There was a Jewish day school. There was a somewhat of a thriving Jewish life there. That's Jews from the early 20th century in Tehran. So it's interesting, of course, but it's come a little bit full circle, because we now have, after the Iranian Revolution under Ayatollah Khomeini, so we had a revival of Haman's hatred. You only have to look at the salute of the Revolutionary Guard. What's the salute they're giving? That's the Nazi salute, because their ideology is basically the same. And, of course, as we know, the previous Prime Minister, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, the nation will soon see the fall of the criminal Zionist regime in America. As the imam said, Israel must be wiped off the map. And they're still saying this type of stuff again and again and again. And, of course, Rembrandt, in his famous painting of Haman, there's Haman and there's Mordechai. Rembrandt, a lot of his paintings have Jewish themes, and a lot. And he was very fascinated by the Jews, and a lot of biblical themes and Jewish themes. So here's Haman. And of course, we understand that the letters were sent to all the countries. Of course, God saved us. God's name is not mentioned in the scroll of Esther. There's only two books of the Tanakh where God's name is not mentioned. One is the scroll of Esther, because God acted in a hidden fashion. There were no open miracles. The Jews have experienced open miracles in past, Exodus and so on. In Babylon, in Persia, we didn't experience open miracles. There was no, nature was not turned on its end. The laws of physics were not abused. Rather, it was all about God's hidden hand. So God's name is not mentioned because it's all something which happens in a hidden fashion. And that is the essence of Purim. And some say that's actually why we drink on Purim, where things are obscured, you don't see too well. But you know deep down, the emotion comes out. And that's indeed so. And of course, every generation, we're going to read in the Haggadah very soon, "V'sha'amda labotenu v'lanu," that not shelo echad bilvad, not only one person, ela she'amad alelcha, stood and tried to destroy us, ela she'bechol dor v'ador, every generation people have tried to destroy us, and Hashem saves us from their hands. Hashem saves us not only through open miracles, but also through giving us strength, through giving us ingenuity, through helping us. I mean, it's an amazing thing. I saw a miracle recently. My son, Arya, who's 21, just not long ago, he's coming from Israel tomorrow. He's in the paratroopers of the IDF. And when he had his, when he got his red beret, when he completed his paratroop training, so my wife was in Israel at the time. She went to see, it's a big deal, all my kids. I have three other children who live in Israel, grandchildren, etc. And the truth is, when I saw that, I watched it online. When I saw that, I said, I'm witnessing a miracle. The Jewish people, after all of these attempts to destroy us, going all the way back to Pharaoh and Haman and all of this stuff, if you roll a dice, the poor, which I hope to get back, by the way, right, if you roll a dice, right, the probability of getting a six is 1 in 6, right? If you roll it a second time, what's the probability of getting a six?
One in six.
Like, if I got 2 sixes, the third time I roll it, what's the probability of getting a six?
1 in 6.
Also 1 in 6. So, however, if you're playing dice with someone and they get 10 sixes in a row, will you just say, well, you know what, each time it's just 1 in 6? Or will you say, this guy is cheating? What will you say? You'll say he's cheating. So every moment in Jewish history, if you would roll, you'd say, well, the probability of the Jews surviving after this is very slim, but yet we survive. Okay, you know, these things happen. But then it happens again. What do you have to say? God is playing with a loaded dice. Right? It's not just probability. And when I see, here, I see my son, right, with his... proudly serving in a Hebrew-speaking army where kosher food is served, where they're given time to pray 3 times a day, where he has got his military-issue green tzitzit. So I remember it's my third son to serve in the army. I remember one of my sons came back. The army sends him back for a month because lone soldiers, parents are here, send him back for a month, which is wonderful. He's coming in tomorrow. And so my son, my other son who was in Givati, he was walking around the house, and I see he's wearing his tzitzit, a green. I said, Pinchas, for God's sake, wash them occasionally. And he says, Abba, they're military-issued tzitzit. Of course they're green. I said, oh, I'm sorry, okay. I did not realize. But that folks, is miraculous. Right? Seeing that, you've got to go back. How far do you have to go back to find a Jewish army? You know, you can go back to... You have to go back to Bar Kochva. It's 156 or so. Right? And that was 2.5 years that lasted. You go back a little earlier to the time of the Second Temple, to the Maccabees, etc. It's a long way you have to go back. It's pretty amazing. But God gives us strength and God gives us inspiration and God's hidden hand is there. And we've been reading the Megillat Esther. This is a little Megillat Esther. It's the Library of Congress, which has got everything pretty much. That's a 14th century scroll. So Jews, 14th century Italy, are reading the same Megillah that we're reading. And we have the same scroll, we have the same parchment, we have the same writing, and we've been celebrating this for centuries and centuries and centuries. It's an amazing thing, looking around here at each other, Jews learning Torah together, celebrating, getting ready to celebrate Purim, getting ready to celebrate Pesach. It is literally... We are witnessing a miracle, and we end the Seder with the Shana Haba'ah, Birushalayim, next year in Jerusalem, and Halavai, it should be next year in Jerusalem, and as the Jews return from Persia to Israel, rebuilt the temple, rebuilt the state. So we have been returning from Lithuania, Belarus, Poland, Russia, Ethiopia, Iran, Iraq, Morocco, Syria, New Zealand,
Australia,
Bandasseri Begawan, Australia, Russia, etc., from literally all over the world to the land of Israel. We are witnessing with our own eyes the ingathering of the exiles, the beginning of that redemptive process, something which Jews for thousands of years did not merit to see, and we have merited to see this. Hopefully, when we have Purim, let's celebrate. It will be a wonderful Purim and a wonderful Pesach and Lashana Haba B'Yerushalayim HaBnuya next year in rebuilt Jerusalem. Those who are interested in studying the subject further, I recommend a couple of books, three, Purim and Persian Empire, which has got a lot of the archaeological information about this, written by Yehuda Landy. The celebration of Purim and how to do it in my book, Gateway to Judaism, and Jewish Timeline Encyclopedia, which is an excellent just timelines of all of Jewish history, paperback format, by actually my 11th grade Talmud teacher from Australia. So those are the three I recommend, and if anyone has any questions, and I'd be happy to take questions.
It's a great opportunity. Purim is just 8 nights from tonight. So this was awesome.
Can you go back to
the
scroll?
Can you just go to the scroll? I'm sorry. Yeah, sure. Rabbi Zaitik, I'm sorry. This one.
That one?
What was the second book in which God's name is not mentioned?
Oh, I didn't mention it.
Right.
Which one is it?
I'm going to.
The other book of the Bible? It's mentioned in an obscure way. It's like at the end of another name. But it's Shir HaShirim, Song of Songs. Song of Songs. No explicit mention of God's name there either. Yeah.
How did it happen that Mordechai, who was a plain person, in fact Jewish, and Esther, who was a queen of Persia, get buried in the same place?
Mordechai was not the plain person. Mordechai was elevated to a great, and after the story, he was elevated to the position of prime minister. He was given the ring of the king. He was given the position of Haman. So he was not just the ordinary person. He was actually a person of great elevated status, greatly respected by the Persians and the Jews, although it says most of the Jews. You know, Jews are, right? Yeah.
Would you say he was kind of status, maybe like Yosef in Egypt?
Very similar. Yeah, absolutely, yes, yeah. Correct. That is absolutely correct. Good comparison. Yes?
What did the Muslims have with the tomb of Daniel? What is their connection
to that? Oh, because Islam traditionally believes in all the prophets of the Torah and the prophets and the writings. To Tanakh, prophets of our Tanakh, are believed by Muslims to be authentic prophets.
Oh, really?
Yes, absolutely. And they also they venerate the prophets of the Jews. They also venerate Jesus as a prophet. However, they believe they have a doctrine called Nusk, which means abrogation, in which each subsequent revelation abrogates the previous revelations, so that they call Muhammad the seal of the prophets. I.e., he abrogated all previous prophecies and he replaced all of them with his prophecy, the Quran. Mm. So the doctrine of Nusk says abrogation, but they still respect and venerate all the prophets of the Tanakh, the Torah, prophets and writings.
So based on what you said, does it mean that they believe that all our prophets in fact Muslims, perhaps?
Well, yes, they have another doctrine called Tahrif. Tahrif means distortion, in which they believe that the Jews distorted the Torah, censored it, took out all references to Muhammad in the Torah, put in superstitious nonsense, and totally took out all references to Islam. So they would say that the version of the Torah that we have, which of course we know existed 1,000 years before it, nevertheless, they say that was tahrif, meaning distorted, either deliberately or in some cases accidentally by the Jews, and hence it's unreliable. So they do, but they do venerate the prophets, and hence the tomb of Daniel is a place that Muslims will go and pray and go and visit and is respected by them. Yeah?
How could Esther live, although we know it had a wonderful outcome, how could she live with a non-Jew, marry him,
was this?
Well, the Talmud asked that question, and the response, there's two responses given in Jewish, in authorities. What the simple response is, to save the entire Jewish people. You know, I can transgress Shabbat to save someone's life. Correct? I cannot transgress incest, adultery, idolatry, or murder to save someone, right? However, that's saving individuals. Saving the whole Jewish people, she was allowed to do that. So she saving the whole Jewish people was the reason she could do that. There is another response given by Tosfot in their commentary, who says that she was never, there was only once that she was actually active in her intimacy with Ahasuerus, which is when she went to him to get the decree rescinded. All other times, she was taken very often against her will, and she was completely passive, and consequently is not liable for any sin. Okay. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you. And I would thank the host.
Great. So, we all want to express our gratitude.